Hello, this is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Friday, May 1st, 2026. We'll start today's reading on the front page with Nuclear Energy, Power and Protection. Clinton Plant, Raising Awareness Through Open Houses. Jess Clifford of Bloomington and her three young children visited the Clinton Power Station on Wednesday to learn more about what her husband, Taylor, does as an equipment manager for the plant. They wanted to come and see where Daddy works and what he does, which is kind of confusing, she said. Representatives of Constellation Energy, which owns and operates the nuclear power plant, were hoping to dispel some of the mysteries behind the plant operations with Wednesday's open house. Plant manager C.J. Smith said it's his hope to make these open houses an annual thing to communicate with constituents and community partners about the plant's success. The Clinton Power Station uses heat from the nuclear core to turn water into steam that then passes through a set of turbines to generate electricity. In one room of the open house, attendees had the chance to put on a full set of protective clothing and equipment, which shield employees from radioactive particles and other contaminants. Nylon shoe covers are worn over the pant leg, and cotton glove liners are then worn under the sleeves. Coveralls zip up to the neck are then put on over the nylon shoe covers, followed by a pair of rubber shoes. Another pair of special gloves go along with a hard hat and specialized hood. Another room was set up for children to create their own atoms and molecules using edible modeling dough. However, many attendees gravitated to the plant's simulator, which is an exact replica of the facility's control room used for training purposes. The plant cannot be licensed without having a simulation program to make sure its operators are properly trained, according to Constellation's Richard Tyler. Even after gaining licensures from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which usually takes between 18 and 24 months, operators must participate in ongoing training for 1 week out of every 5 weeks they spend on shift operating the plant. This includes additional emergency training on the simulator. Engineers simulated a variety of different emergency situations, such as an earthquake and a scram, which is a sudden shutdown of a nuclear reactor, most often triggered by the rapid insertion of control rods that absorb neutrons to slow fission in the reactor, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Tyler said situations like these are routine business for the plant's operators, and he has so much confidence that his farm is within 4 miles of the plant. I always tell these guys, we're protecting not only the public, we're protecting my farm animals that I have and everything in all of our communities around, Tyler said. The plant is subject to numerous other safety inspections and audits. Two NRC resident inspectors are usually on site to conduct regular inspections, monitor plant operations and major work projects, and interact with employees and the public. Last year, Constellation entered into a 20-year power purchase agreement with tech and social media giant Meta, which will allow the plant to maintain operations through 2047 and expand its energy output by 30 megawatts. That's guaranteeing our power and guarantees us as a provider of power for the local communities and for businesses that surround us, Smith said. As a result, Constellation would invest $370 million in state-of-the-art upgrades for the plant. The company said it has already invested more than $3 billion in its nuclear facilities in Illinois to ensure that they run safely and efficiently. And the photos here on page A6 show Constellation's Richard Tyler in the center of a bunch of people here, talking to attendees of the simulation about the simulation main control room on Wednesday during a community open house titled Green Energy Center Community Open House at the Constellation Nuclear Training Department building in Clinton. And there are several people surrounding or in a semicircle around Mr. Tyler. And in the background, there's several machines with lots of lights, and who knows what they're all for. But and then there's a desk with computers there, too. And the second picture shows Constellation's Zach Quinn in the center of the picture here, talking to attendees about the simulation main control room on Wednesday during a community open house titled Clean Energy Center Community Open House at the Constellation Nuclear Training Department building in Clinton. And again, there's actually there's just two people there, Mr. Quinn and someone standing behind him. And again, machines behind him. And the smaller picture here on page A6 shows Constellation's Crystal Hendricks helping Nicholas McDermott try on some safety equipment on Wednesday during a community open house titled, again, Clean Energy Center Community Open House at Constellation Nuclear Training Department building in Clinton. That's a mouthful. And Nicholas McDermott looks to be about 5 or 6 years old. And so Crystal Hendricks is down on the floor on her squatting down, helping him in this safety suit. And the large photo on the front page, excuse me, again show Nicholas McDermott on the left posing in safety gear with his father, Justin McDermott, on Wednesday during a community open house titled Clean Energy Center Community Open House at the Constellation Nuclear Training Department building in Clinton. Justin works at Constellation. Also on the front page, Decatur Mansion brings history to life. Sangamon Valley students meet with President Grant and Illinois Governor Oglesby. To prepare for the role of President Ulysses S. Grant, Bill Horton read several books about Grant, and he confessed with a chuckle, World Book Encyclopedia. Horton, Tim Lee as Governor Richard Oglesby, Patty Barr as Emma Oglesby, and Selah Osborne and Josie Nybruge as the family maids perform a play about Grant's visit to the Oglesby Mansion in Decatur in 1880 for audiences of fifth-grade students from Decatur and the surrounding area. The mansion at 421 West William Street was restored some years ago and is open for tours on select Sundays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays. And in the spring, the play is performed for students whose teachers sign up for the free performances and tours of the mansion. The hope, Horton said, is that the visit to the mansion will spark an interest in history, specifically local and Illinois history, and perhaps architecture as well. Oglesby was a master carpenter who created much of the intricate woodwork in the mansion and was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln. As Oglesby, Lee told Grant in the play that he was supposed to accompany the Lincolns to the Ford Theater on the night Lincoln was assassinated, but he was so tired from a long trip that he bowed out. After the play, they get to talk to the actors in different rooms and kind of show them around the two different rooms, said board member Barb Hipple, who calls her role herding the cats, as she organizes the students and helps keep things running smoothly. Part of the missions of the Oglesby Mansion is education, and I don't know how long this play's been going on, but we choose to have the play every year for fifth grade classes. It's part of their education to teach them the history of the mansion, a little bit about the governor and the president, and that era that they lived in. The play was written by members of the English department at Millikan University in the 1980s, and the actors still use the same script, with a few minor changes. Every effort is made to be authentic in costume and conversation, and the actors remain in character even after the play is over, when they answer questions from the students. Grant met Oglesby in the Civil War, and they became friends in the army, Horton said. Then they became political allies after the war. We're reminiscing about some of our background in the play, and this is where Oglesby tells me about his childhood and establishing himself. Each character suggested to the students, as they handed them off to the next character, a question to ask the next character and, in quotes, President Grant, told the students that they should ask Oglesby, in quotes, about the Battle of Corinth. He was wounded in that battle, and removing the bullet that entered his lung and lodged behind it would have been too dangerous and could have paralyzed him or killed him. So he still carried it, he told the students. Wednesday's fifth graders came from Sangamon Valley Middle School, and Jackson Netterville said that he had no idea what the mansion was until the visit. I thought it was just another house, he said. The visit was enlightening, he said, and he enjoyed the play and seeing how life was lived in the 1880s. And the photos here on page A6, large photo shows Bill Horton answering questions from Sangamon Valley Middle School fifth graders as he portrays President Ulysses S. Grant at the Governor Richard J. Oglesby Mansion in Decatur on Wednesday, April 29th. And Mr. Horton is in period clothing from the 1880s. And you see a very beautiful walls and appointments in the mansion behind him. We see the backs of the kids' heads. They're sitting on the floor, and one child has his hand raised to ask a question. And a smaller photo shows Tim Lee as Governor Richard J. Oglesby talking to Sangamon Valley Middle School fifth graders at the Oglesby Mansion in Decatur on Wednesday, April 29th. And again, we see more beautiful parts of the mansion, and behind Mr. Lee, there's a mirrored or a glassed cupboard in the wall, and reflected in that behind him are the students who are surrounding the table that's also reflected in the mirror. And again, Mr. Lee is maybe he's in period clothing, but men's clothing didn't change all that much. So I guess he's wearing what Governor Oglesby would have worn at the time. And a photo on the front page shows Sangamon Valley Middle School fifth grader Laura Bledsaw trying on a hat with the help of Patty Barr as Emma Oglesby at the Governor Richard J. Oglesby Mansion in Decatur on Wednesday. And Patty Barr is in costume of the time, and she has a little hat on her head, a little, I don't know if she's a... she's the wife of Governor Oglesby. And the hat, it sits on top of Laura Bledsaw's head, and then it's tied with long ribbons underneath. And again, we see other accoutrements of the mansion, some lace curtains, a kerosene-type lamp, and pictures on the wall. In local news on page A2, teen pleads to attempted murder. Brendan K. Ford is just a week away from turning 18, and now a fit of murderous anger 8 months ago means he will spend most of his next 16 birthdays sitting in a prison cell as punishment for trying to shoot a man to death. Ford appeared Wednesday in Macon County Circuit Court and admitted he attempted murder of the 25-year-old Decatur victim he shot twice in a dispute over a dirt bike Ford claimed had been stolen. The plea was part of a deal negotiated by defense attorney Edwin Pirino. The deal saw a possible 20-year additional sentence for the use of a firearm get dropped to leave sentencing range from 6 to 30 years. Presiding Judge Thomas Griffith sentenced Ford to 16 years with the stipulation he must serve 85% of that sentence. Ford has one more week left in juvenile detention where he's been held since his arrest for the crime, which dates to August 8th. After he turns 18, he will be shifted to the Macon County Jail and then begin his transition to adult prison. In the meantime, an alleged accomplice in the crime awaits his day in court in connection with the same attack on the Decatur victim, Drew C. Ford, 36. And he's facing, Drew C. Ford, 36, is facing charges of aggravated battery, mob action, two counts of being a felon in possession of a weapon, and two counts of aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon. He has consistently pleaded not guilty, and his trial is due to begin in the circuit court May 11th. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department about the crime said Brendan Ford, riding a motorcycle, had been chasing the victim who was riding the dirt bike he had been accused of stealing. The victim is quoted as telling police Ford had pulled alongside of him and pointed a gun at him. The victim stated he put his hand up and said, "Whoa," at which time Brendan shot him, the affidavit said. The victim said he grabbed his stomach area in pain and again looked up at Brendan, at which time Brendan shot him again, which caused him to crash the motorbike. The victim was described as begging for his life at that point when Drew Ford, who had been part of the pursuit, walked over to him and stomped on his head. The bleeding victim said he had feigned unconsciousness after that, and both defendants collected the dirt bike and loaded it onto the back of a truck before driving off. The defendant almost took a new father from his unborn son and a loved one from his relatives, said the victim in a statement read out to the court, and he did it with no mercy. The victim's 24-year-old fiance, pregnant at the time with the baby that would become his son, recalled how her boyfriend had phoned her after being shot. "He called me while he was bleeding out on the pavement to tell me he loved me and that he was sorry. He said, 'Tell our baby I loved him so much.'" She said her fiance came close to death and went through four major surgeries and 46 days in the hospital as doctors fought to save him. "He didn't deserve to be murdered, and thankfully God had other plans for him," she added. The victim's 46-year-old mother, in her statement, told Ford, "When you shot my son, you destroyed a family and a future. Not one of you intended, but your own." The victim has a son to raise, and a fiance to marry, and a family to love and to continue to make memories with. "You have now taken those opportunities away from yourself and your family. I pray you find peace and forgiveness. Life is so much more valuable than a dirt bike." In lighter news, Fest combines craft beer, coffee, cars. The Decatur Craft Beer Festival will be from noon to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 2nd in Central Park. The day will start off early with cars and coffee beginning at 8 a.m. Vendors will join the event at 10 a.m. Food trucks, handmade goods, live music will be part of the festivities. General admission is $40, which will include a souvenir tasting glass, unlimited tastings, and access to the food trucks. Non-alcoholic festival tickets are available for $10. VIP tickets are $80 and will also include a pretzel necklace, snacks, and access to special beers and ciders. The VIP event will be held in the transfer house with access to indoor restrooms. Proceeds from the event will benefit Decatur Area Arts Council. Tickets and information are available at DecaturArts.org. Again, that's all one word, DecaturArts.org, or by calling 217-423-3189. Again, 217-423-3189. University of Illinois. Cow caught after impromptu campus tour. This is from the News Gazette in Champaign, Urbana. A cow that took a jaunt across the University of Illinois campus Wednesday afternoon has been safely recovered and is receiving veterinary care, said Patrick Wade, Director of Executive Communications and Issues Management. The bovine got loose while being unloaded about 3:30 p.m. from a trailer at the College of Veterinary Medicine's large animal clinic. Personnel from VetMed, the College of Agricultural, Consumer and Environmental Sciences, and the Division of Public Safety followed the animal as it traveled through Mount Hope Cemetery, south of campus, and continued north toward campus grounds, ultimately resting near Follinger Auditorium, Wade said. He added that the cow sustained some superficial injuries, but is not expected to need additional treatment, and no people were seriously injured. We appreciate the quick and coordinated action of our campus teams in handling an unpredictable situation, Wade said. One Reddit user posted a video of the cow joking that police officers were harassing it for trying to study at the main library. In state news, on page A3, Illinois remap amendment punted. Lawmakers look to protect voting rights as SCOTUS strikes congressional district. This is from Springfield. Illinois lawmakers are not planning to pursue a constitutional amendment on redistricting after a key U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Wednesday. Senate President Don Harmon, Democrat of Oak Park, told Capital News Illinois that Senate Democrats decided not to call an amendment that passed House last week after the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a hefty blow to the Federal Voting Rights Act. If approved by voters, it would have rewritten the state's redistricting rules. We want to spend a little bit of time unpacking the Supreme Court decision to make sure we get it right and protect the Voting Rights Act of Illinois residents, Harmon said. It's much better and much more important to get this correct than to do it quickly. The worst thing that could happen is if we rushed and there were unintended consequences that undermine people's voting rights. But that means the matter will have to wait until at least 2028 as lawmakers faced a May 3rd deadline to approve constitutional amendments for voters to consider in November. The proposed amendment would have inserted a provision from the Voting Rights Act into the state constitution to specifically direct lawmakers to consider race in drawing district lines. The Voting Rights Act provision has long been interpreted as a ban on splitting large majority groups into multiple legislative districts to dilute their voting power. The U.S. Supreme Court, however, struck down Louisiana's congressional map on Wednesday, ruling a district drawn to consolidate black voters was illegally gerrymandered based on race. While the decision did not broadly eliminate the section of the Voting Rights Act, dissenting liberal Justice Elena Kagan suggested it is all but a dead letter. Racial intent. David Becker, founder and executive director of the Nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research, called the decision a radical change in the way voting rights cases are now reviewed. When I woke up this morning, we had functional Voting Rights Act, he said during media briefings on the case Wednesday, and unfortunately, I can't say that anymore. Prior to Wednesday's decision, he said plaintiffs in voting rights cases only had to show that a set of maps had the effect of diluting a minority group's voting strength. Not that there was a specific intent to discriminate. Wednesday's decision, he said, reverses that standard and provides what he calls a clear roadmap for how a state legislature can engage in racial gerrymandering without it being declared illegal. All it has to do is to be very careful about talking about intent, he said. Don't talk about intent at all. Couch everything in partisanship, and then it can't even be really reviewed because racial effects aren't going to be enough to establish a violation, even if those racial effects are stark. Illinois' reaction. Illinois House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, Democrat of Hillside, said fear that the court would strike down protections for racial groups inspired him to pursue the constitutional amendment. While the court did not go that far, the ruling that lawmakers cannot draw maps based on race affirmed many Democrats' fears. The decision by the Supreme Court today on the Voting Rights Act is an abomination, Governor J.B. Pritzker told reporters in Chicago. It is an attack on a crown jewel of our democracy. Illinois' proposed amendment would have established a priority list stating what factors lawmakers should consider in the redistricting process. It stated that they should draw districts to be substantially equal in population to ensure that no citizen is denied an equal opportunity to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of his or her choice on account of race, to create, where practical, racial coalition influence districts to be contiguous and, to the extent practicable, to be compact. Harmon said, the ruling highlights how much the court would frown upon race being a predominant factor in drawing districts. The Illinois Voting Rights Act, which was established in 2011, requires lawmakers to create crossover districts where minority groups are a large enough share of the population to potentially elect their preferred candidate and influence districts where a racial minority is large enough to sway the outcome of an election toward their preferred candidate. Political fight. House Republicans argued last week that the amendment was in response to a lawsuit they filed last year that sought to overturn the state's legislative map by alleging dozens of districts failed to meet a decades-old Illinois Supreme Court precedent that defined an appropriately compact map. The Illinois Supreme Court ultimately tossed the lawsuit, ruling it was filed too late. They said the proposed constitutional amendment would give Democrats more leeway to draw heavily gerrymandered districts that snake around communities. This Supreme Court decision addresses the very gerrymandering efforts the Democrats are hoping to codify into Illinois law with this constitutional amendment. The Illinois Freedom Caucus, a group of far-right Republicans, said in a statement, House Joint Constitutional Amendment 28 is now very nearly unconstitutional. New congressional maps are not in General Assembly Democrats' plans for now either. The possibility was floated last year as other states began redrawing their boundaries in Congress, but talks in Illinois faded after Indiana Republicans decided not to attempt a mid-decade remap. I think we have an excellent congressional map that reflects the communities of interest across the state, Harmon said, and I'm not sure that we could, and if we could, whether we should draw a district that leans more one way or the other, he said. And that's all we have time for the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Friday, May 1st, 2026. This is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.